I mean ruling, within the city, over those who share in citizenship and deal with one another.
What skill is this, then? Suppose I asked you again as before, what skill enables one to rule people who share in seafaring?
Piloting.
And what knowledge enables one to rule people who share in singing, as we just said?
The very one you just mentioned, chorus training.
Well then, what do you call the knowledge that rules people who share in citizenship?
Good judgment, Socrates, I'd say.
Really? Is the pilot's skill a kind of poor judgment?
No, indeed.
It's good judgment, then.
So it seems to me good judgment aimed at keeping the passengers safe.
Well put. Now, this good judgment you speak of, what is it aimed at?
At governing the city better and keeping it safe.
And what is present or absent when the city is governed and kept safe better? Suppose you ask me, what is present or absent that makes a body better governed and kept safe? I'd say, health present, disease absent. Don't you think the same?
Yes.
And if you ask me again, what presence makes eyes better? I'd likewise say, sight present, blindness absent. And ears, when deafness is absent and hearing is present, become better and better cared for.
Right.
Well then, what presence or absence makes a city better, better cared for, and better governed?
It seems to me, Socrates, when friendship arises among the citizens toward one another, and hatred and factional strife are absent.
By friendship, do you mean agreement or disagreement?
Agreement.
Through what skill do cities agree about numbers?
Through arithmetic.
And private individuals, isn't it through the same skill?
Yes.
And each person with himself?
Yes.
Through what skill does each person agree with himself about which is longer, a handspan or a cubit? Isn't it through the art of measurement?
Of course.
And don't private individuals agree with one another the same way? And cities, too.
Yes.
And about weight, isn't it the same?
I'd agree.
But this agreement you speak of, what is it, and about what, and what skill produces it? And is it the same for a city as for a private person, both with himself and with another?
It's likely to be.
What is it, then? Don't tire of answering, press on and tell me.
I suppose I mean friendship and agreement of the sort a father has toward a son whom he loves, and a mother, and a brother toward a brother, and a wife toward a husband.
Do you think, Alcibiades, that a man could agree with a woman about wool working, if he doesn't understand it and she does?
No, indeed.
Nor does he need to, that's a woman's skill.
Yes.
And could a woman agree with a man about soldiery, without having learned it?
No, indeed.
That, I suppose you'd say, is a man's skill in turn.
I would.
So by your account, some subjects belong to women, others to men.
Of course.
Then in these matters, at least, there is no agreement between women and men.
No.
Nor friendship either, if friendship was agreement.
Apparently not.
So insofar as women do their own tasks, they aren't loved by men on that account.
It seems not.
Nor are men loved by women, on account of doing their own tasks.
No.
Then cities aren't well run on this basis either, when each group does its own tasks.
I do think they are, Socrates.
What do you mean, when the friendship we said had to be present for cities to be well run is absent?
But it seems to me that friendship does arise among them precisely on this basis, that each group does its own tasks.
That's not what you said a moment ago. Now what are you saying that friendship arises where agreement is absent? Or can agreement arise about matters where some know them and others don't?
Impossible.
And when each group does its own tasks, are they acting justly or unjustly?
Justly, of course.
And when citizens in a city act justly, doesn't friendship arise among them?
It seems necessary again, Socrates.
Then what do you mean by this friendship or agreement about which we need to become wise and well-judging, in order to be good men? I can't grasp either what it is or in whom it resides. Sometimes it appears present in the same people, sometimes not, going by what you say.
But by the gods, Socrates, I don't even know myself what I'm saying. It seems I've long been unaware, without noticing, of being in a most shameful state.
Well, you should take heart. If you had noticed this at 50, it would be hard for you to attend to yourself. But as it is, you're just the age at which one ought to notice it.
And once someone notices it, Socrates, what should he do?
Answer the questions put to him, Alcibiades. If you do that, then, God willing, if my prophetic sense is to be trusted at all, both you and I will be better off.
It will be so, at least as far as my answering goes.
Come then, what is it to take care of oneself, since we might easily miss the mark and think we're caring for ourselves when we're not? And when exactly does a person do this? Is it when he cares for what belongs to him that he's also caring for himself?
That's how it seems to me, anyway.
Well then, when does a person care for his feet? Isn't it when he cares for whatever belongs to the feet?
I don't follow.
Do you call anything the property of the hand? For instance, would you say a ring belongs to any part of a person other than a finger?
No, certainly not.
And a shoe belongs to the foot the same way?
Yes.
And clothes and bedding belong to the rest of the body in the same way?
Yes.
So when we care for our shoes, are we then caring for our feet?
I still don't quite follow, Socrates.
Well, Alcibiades, do you call caring for something correctly by some name?
I do.
So when someone makes a thing better, do you call that correct care?
Yes.
What skill then makes shoes better?
Shoemaking.
So it's by shoemaking that we care for shoes?
Yes.
But do we care for the foot by shoemaking too, or by whatever skill makes feet better?
By that other skill.
And isn't it the same skill that makes feet better as makes the rest of the body better?
I think so.
And isn't that skill gymnastics?
Certainly.
So it's by gymnastics that we care for the foot, and by shoemaking for what belongs to the foot.
Quite so.
And by gymnastics for the hands, and by ring engraving for what belongs to the hand.
Yes.
And by gymnastics for the body, and by weaving and the other crafts for what belongs to the body.
Absolutely.
So it's by one skill that we care for the thing itself, and by another that we care for what belongs to it.
So it appears.
Then when you care for what's yours, you aren't caring for yourself.
Not at all.
Because, it seems, the skill by which one would care for oneself is not the same as the one for caring for what belongs to oneself.
It doesn't appear to be.
Come then, by what skill could we care for ourselves?
I can't say.
But at least this much we've agreed, that it's not a skill by which we'd make any of our belongings better, but one by which we'd make ourselves better.
True.
Now, could we ever have known what skill makes a shoe better without knowing what a shoe is?
Impossible.
Nor what skill makes rings better if we're ignorant of what a ring is?
True.
Well then, what skill makes a person better? Could we ever know that while being ignorant of what we ourselves actually are?
Impossible.
So is it in fact easy to know oneself? And was whoever set up that inscription in the temple at Delphi some ordinary fellow? Or is it something difficult, not for just anyone?
To me, Socrates, it's often seemed like anyone could do it, and often seemed extremely difficult.
But Alcibiades, whether it's easy or not, this much holds for us regardless. If we know it, we might quickly know how to care for ourselves, but if we don't know it, we never could.
That's so.
Come then, in what way might the thing itself be discovered? For that way, we might quickly find out what we ourselves actually are, whereas remaining ignorant of this, we're presumably unable to.
You're right.
So hold on, for God's sake. Who are you talking with right now? Anyone but me?
Yes, you.
And I with you?
Yes.
So it's Socrates who is doing the talking?
Certainly.
And Alcibiades who is listening?
Yes.
And Socrates converses using speech?
Of course.
And conversing and using speech you'd call the same thing, I suppose?
Certainly.
But isn't the user distinct from what he uses?
What do you mean?
Take a shoemaker. He cuts with a knife and an awl and other tools, doesn't he?
Yes.
So the one who cuts and uses tools is distinct from the tools he uses in cutting?
Of course.
And in the same way, would what the harpist plays with be distinct from the harpist himself?
Yes.
This, then, is what I was just asking, whether the user always seems distinct from what he uses.
It does seem so.
So what shall we say of the shoemaker? Does he cut only with his tools, or with his hands too?
With his hands too.
So he uses those as well?
Yes.
And does he also use his eyes in shoemaking?
Yes.
And we agree, the user is distinct from what he uses.
Yes.
So the shoemaker and the harpist are distinct from the hands and eyes they work with.
So it appears.
And doesn't a person use his whole body too?
Certainly.
And the user was distinct from what he uses.
Yes.
So a person is distinct from his own body.
It seems so.
Then what on earth is the person?
I can't say.
You can say this much at least, that it's whatever uses the body.
Yes.
And does anything use it other than the soul?
Nothing else.
Ruling it then?
Yes.
And here's something I don't think anyone could think otherwise about.
What's that?
That a person must be one of three things.
Which three?
Soul or body, or the two together as one whole.
Of course.
But we agreed that whatever rules the body is the person.
We did.
So does the body rule itself?
Not at all.
For we said it is ruled.
Yes.
Then this couldn't be what we're looking for.
It doesn't seem to be.
Well, does the combination of both rule the body, and is this then the person?
Perhaps so.
Least of all possibilities. For if one of the two isn't ruling along with it, there's no way the combination could rule at all.
Right.
And since neither the body nor the combination of both is the person, what's left, I think, is either that the person is nothing at all, or, if it is something, that it turns out to be nothing other than the soul.
Exactly so.
Do you need it demonstrated to you still more clearly that the soul is the person?
No, by Zeus, it seems sufficient to me as it is.
And if it's not exact but only roughly adequate, that's enough for us. We'll know it exactly when we've worked out something we passed over just now because it needed lengthy examination.
What's that?
What was just now put something like this, that first we ought to examine the very thing itself, but instead of the thing itself, we've examined what each particular thing is. And perhaps that will be enough, for surely we could say nothing has more authority over us than the soul.
No, indeed.
So isn't it right to think of it this way, that you and I are conversing with each other, using speech, soul to soul?
Quite so.
This, then, is exactly what we said a little earlier, that Socrates converses with Alcibiades using speech, addressing his words not to your face, it seems, but to Alcibiades himself, and that is the soul.
So it seems to me.
So the one who commands us to know ourselves is telling us to come to know our soul.
So it seems.
So whoever comes to know something belonging to the body has come to know his own belongings, but not himself.
That's right.
So no doctor knows himself, insofar as he's a doctor, nor does any trainer, insofar as he's a trainer.
It doesn't seem so.
So farmers and other craftsmen are far indeed from knowing themselves, for it seems they don't even know their own belongings, but something still further removed than their belongings, given the skills they practice, for they know only the things that serve to tend the body.
True.
So if self-knowledge is temperance, none of these people is temperate in virtue of his craft.
I don't think so.
And that's exactly why these crafts are considered menial and unfit for study by a good man.
Quite so.
So again, whoever tends the body tends his belongings, but not himself.
It looks that way.
And whoever tends money tends neither himself nor his belongings, but something still further removed from himself.
I think so.
So the businessman is no longer even attending to his own affairs.
Right.
So if someone has become a lover of Alcibiades' body, he wasn't in love with Alcibiades, but with something belonging to Alcibiades.
True.
But whoever loves your soul.
That must follow from the argument.
So the one who loves your body once it stops blooming, goes away and leaves.
So it seems.
But the one who loves the soul doesn't leave, so long as it's moving toward what's better.
That's likely.
So I am the one who doesn't leave but stays on as your body fades, while the others have gone off.
And you do well in that, Socrates, please don't leave.
Then be eager to become as fine as possible.
I will make the effort.
For this is how things stand with you. Alcibiades, son of Cleinias, has had, it seems, no lover, nor has one now, except a single one and a dear one at that, Socrates, son of Sophroniscus and Phinere.
True.
And didn't you say, I only just barely got to you first, when you would otherwise have come to me first, wanting to find out why I alone don't go away?
Yes, that's how it was.
Well, the reason is this. I alone was your lover, while the others were lovers of your belongings. And your belongings are fading with your youth, while you yourself are just beginning to bloom. And now, if you aren't corrupted by the Athenian people and made uglier, I will never abandon you. This is exactly what I fear most, that you'll become a lover of the people and be corrupted by it. Many good men among the Athenians have already suffered this fate. For the people of great-hearted Erechtheus wear a handsome face, but one must see it stripped bare. So be on guard against the very danger I'm describing.
Which danger is that?
Train first, blessed one, and learn what you need to learn before going into public affairs, and not before, so that you go armed with a remedy and suffer nothing terrible.
I think you're right, Socrates, but try to explain in what way we might take care of ourselves.
Well, we've made this much progress so far. What we are has been reasonably well agreed upon, and we were worried that, missing that mark, we might unknowingly be caring for something else instead of ourselves.
That's so.
And after that, that it's the soul we must care for, and it's to this that we must look.
Clearly.
And the care of bodies and money must be handed over to others.
Of course.
So in what way might we know the soul most clearly? Since knowing this, it seems, we'll also come to know ourselves. Good heavens, are we failing to grasp what that Delphic inscription we just mentioned is well saying?
What do you have in mind by that, Socrates?
I'll tell you what I suspect this inscription means and is advising us. There isn't likely to be much of a parallel for it, except in the case of sight.
What do you mean by that?
Consider it with me. If it addressed one of our eyes as though it were a person and advised, "See yourself," how would we understand what it was urging? Wouldn't it be to look at that in which the eye, by looking, would see itself?
Clearly.
So let's think what, among existing things, we could look at and see both that thing and ourselves at the same time.
Clearly, Socrates, mirrors and things like that.
You're right. And isn't there something of that sort present in the eye with which we see?
Certainly.
Have you noticed that when someone looks into an eye, his face appears in the eye facing him, as if in a mirror, the thing we call the pupil, since it is a kind of image of the one looking in?
That's true.
So an eye that looks at an eye, and looks at that particular part of it which is best and by which it sees, would in this way see itself.
So it seems.
But if it looks at anything else belonging to a person, or at anything else that exists, except the thing it happens to resemble, it will not see itself.
That's true.
So if an eye is going to see itself, it must look at an eye, and specifically at that region of the eye where an eye's excellence happens to reside. And this, I take it, is sight.
Just so.
Well then, dear Alcibiades, if a soul is going to know itself, must it not also look at a soul, and especially at that region of itself where a soul's excellence, wisdom, comes to be, and at whatever else resembles that?
I think so, Socrates.
Can we say that anything about the soul is more godlike than this? The part concerned with knowing and understanding.
We cannot.
So this part of it resembles the divine, and whoever looks at that, and comes to know everything divine, God, and understanding, would in this way come to know himself best of all.
So it appears.
Now, just as mirrors can be clearer, purer, and brighter than the mirror in the eye, isn't God also clearer and brighter than the best part of our own soul?
It does seem so, Socrates.
So by looking toward God, we would be using the finest mirror there is for human affairs, to see the excellence of the soul, and in this way we would see and know ourselves best.
Yes.
And didn't we agree that knowing oneself is soundness of mind?
Certainly.
So if we do not know ourselves and lack soundness of mind, could we know what is bad and good for us?
How could that happen, Socrates?
I imagine it seems impossible to you that someone who doesn't know Alcibiades could know that something belongs to Alcibiades, precisely because it is his.
Impossible indeed, by Zeus.
Nor then could he know that what is ours, if he doesn't even know us ourselves.
How could he?
And if he doesn't even know what is ours, he can't know what belongs to what is ours either.
It seems not.
So we weren't quite right just now when we agreed that there are people who don't know themselves, yet know their own affairs, and others who know the affairs of such people. It looks like all of this, knowing oneself, one's own affairs, and the affairs of one's own affairs, belongs to one and the same skill.
It looks that way.
And whoever is ignorant of his own affairs would likewise be ignorant of other people's affairs too.
Of course.
And if he's ignorant of other people's affairs, he'll be ignorant of the affairs of states as well.
Necessarily.
Such a man could never become a statesman then.
Certainly not.
Nor even a manager of a household, for that matter.
Certainly not.
Nor will he even know what he is doing.
No, indeed.
And won't the one who doesn't know make mistakes?
Certainly.
And making mistakes, won't he fare badly, both in his own life and in public affairs?
How could he not?
And faring badly, isn't he wretched?
Very much so.
And what of those for whom he acts?
They too.
So it's not possible to be happy unless one is sound of mind and good.
It isn't possible.
So bad people are wretched.
Very much so.
So it isn't the man who has grown rich who escapes wretchedness, but the man who has grown sound of mind.
So it appears.
So states have no need of walls, or triremes, or dockyards, Alcibiades, if they mean to be happy, nor of numbers or size, without excellence.
No, indeed.
So if you intend to manage the city's affairs rightly and well, you must give the citizens a share of excellence.
Of course.
But could anyone give a share of something he doesn't have himself?
How could he?
So you yourself must first acquire excellence, and so must anyone who intends not merely to govern and look after himself and his own affairs privately, but the city and the city's affairs.
That's true.
So it isn't power or authority you must arrange for yourself, to do whatever you like, nor for the city either, but justice and soundness of mind.
So it appears.
For by acting justly and soundly, you and the city will act in a way pleasing to the gods.
Likely enough.
And as we said before, you will act looking toward what is divine and bright.
So it appears.
And indeed, looking in that direction, you will see and come to know yourselves and your own good.
Yes.
And so you will act rightly and well.
Yes.
But truly, if you act this way, I am willing to guarantee that you will be happy.
You are a reliable guarantor.
But if you act unjustly, looking toward what is godless and dark, then likely enough you will act just as such things suggest, not knowing yourselves.
So it seems.
For consider, dear Alcibiades, when someone has the power to do whatever he wishes but lacks understanding, what is likely to happen to him, whether a private man or even a city? Take someone sick, who has the power to do as he pleases but lacks a physician's understanding and is a tyrant besides, so that no one can rebuke him. What will happen? Won't his body, in all likelihood, be ruined?
That's true.
And on a ship, if someone had the power to do as he saw fit, but was without understanding and the skill of a helmsman, do you see what would happen to him and his shipmates?
I do, they would all perish.
And likewise in a city, and in every office and position of power, doesn't faring badly follow wherever excellence is absent?
Necessarily.
So it isn't tyranny you should be preparing, my excellent Alcibiades, for yourself or for the city, if you mean to be happy but excellence.
That's true.
and before one has excellence. It is better for a man, not just a child, to be ruled by someone better than to rule.
So it appears.
And what is better is also finer.
Yes.
And what is finer is more fitting.
How could it not be?
So it is fitting for the bad man to be a slave, since that is better for him.
Yes.
So badness is a slavish thing.
So it appears.
And excellence is a fitting mark of the free.
Yes.
So one ought to flee, my friend, from what is slavish.
Most certainly, Socrates.
And do you now perceive how you stand, in a manner fitting the free, or not?
I think I perceive it only too clearly.
Do you know, then, how you might escape your present condition? Let's not put a name to it, for a man of your promise.
I do.
How?
If you are willing, Socrates.
That's not well said, Alcibiades.
Then how should I say it?
That it will happen if God is willing.
I say it then, and besides this I say something more. It looks as though we're about to exchange roles, Socrates. I'll take yours and you mine. For there's no way I won't be your tutor from this day on, and you'll be tutored by me.
My noble friend, then my love will be no different from a stork's. Once it has hatched a winged love in you, it will in turn be cared for by that very love.
Well, that is how things stand, and I shall begin from this very point to attend to justice.
I would wish you to keep it up to the end, but I am uneasy, not that I distrust your nature, but because I see the strength of the city, and I fear it may get the better of both you and me.